Nourish your mind with a premium digital subscription with the Irish Times and enjoy 12 months free access to the Headspace app. Visit irishtimes.com. Terms and conditions apply.
It's Friday, October the 18th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, and it's the day after the new agreement on Brexit between the UK and the EU, and it's the day before the agreement is put before the House of Commons in Westminster for what all observers agree is going to be an incredibly tight vote. I'll be joined a little bit later by Fintan O'Toole to discuss what the deal means for Ireland, for the UK, and for Northern Ireland. But first I'm joined by our London editor, Dennis Staunton. Dennis, there's a lot of feverish speculation about the numbers and how they might fall in the House of Commons vote tomorrow. What's your read on it?
Well, it's a kind of a complicated balancing act. If you look at the picture of what he's got to do, he has to get about 320 votes. That's assuming no abstentions or that nobody stays at home or whatever. And there are 285 Conservative MPs. And the groups that he's looking at that he has to get support from, one is the 21 Conservatives who no longer have the whip, who fell out with him over the issue of a no-deal Brexit, and they lost the whip in the last couple of months. And he has to try to get them on board, or most of them. And then there's the 28 Conservative Brexiteers who voted against Theresa May's deal on the third occasion, when he, in fact, and Jacob Rees-Mogg voted in favour of it, and he needs to get nearly all of them. And then the other pool of votes really is, or potential votes, is 19 Labour MPs who have indicated that they would like to have a Brexit deal, and if a Brexit deal came that they could vote for it, then they would like to vote for it. And then there's also a few independents who are former Labour MPs who might be up for grabs as well. And the problem that he's got really is that the inducements that he's making to one group to get them across the line, that can alienate a different group. So, for example, the Brexiteers, most of them are likely to vote in favour of the deal. About half of them have more or less said so in public that they're going to do so. But there's so then the question is, how low can you get the holdouts? And one of the things that Boris Johnson's allies have been saying to them is that, look, once we get to the end of the transition period, if we haven't got a free trade agreement, or if the negotiations aren't going well towards a free trade agreement, then we'll just leave. We'll just be gone. The transition period will end at the end of next year. And then if there is no free trade agreement, then we'll just go on a no-deal WTO rules basis. And that reassures some of them that he's actually still ready for a completely clean Brexit, as they would call it. The problem with that, of course, is that that alienates two other groups. And so, for example, the Conservative rebels, the 21 without the whip, are people like Philip Hammond, former Chancellor, who is concerned about the impact of this deal on the British economy. And I think Philip Hammond probably will vote for it, but they had thought that they would probably get at least 15 of these 21, maybe 17, maybe 18. And now it looks as if those numbers are softening a bit because of some concerns. There's been some information overnight about the likely economic impact of the deal, although the government hasn't produced its assessment. But so those votes are not quite certain. I mean, some of them, like Dominic Grieve, for example, is likely to vote against the deal in any case, because essentially he wants a second referendum and he wants to reverse Brexit. And he's also going to stand as an independent against the Conservative Party. He's already essentially cut his ties with the Conservative Party. Then when you look at the Labour benches, what they need really is reassurance about things like employment rights. And so written into the revised political declaration is this commitment to maintaining standards and employment and social rights. But they complain that that's in the non-binding part of the text, and so they can't necessarily trust him to do anything about it. Now, what you may get is a pledge or some kind of an amendment even, promising to bring in domestic legislation to take care of that. But then you've got a few sort of variables. So, for example, the figure of Kate Hoey, Labour MP for Vauxhall, who has consistently voted against Theresa May's deal. But she's also consistently voted with the DUP. So she is somebody, she's been tweeting quite a lot in the last 24 hours. She hasn't actually said yet how she's going to vote, but she has been tweeting kind of conflicting things. Sometimes she's tweeting stuff that the DUP are tweeting, which is condemning the deal. Then at other times, she seems to be tweeting or retweeting stuff that's in support of it. So she's quite difficult to read. And then among those hardline Brexiteers, there's a group that the DUP are working on. Nigel Dodds, the leader of the DUP in the House of Commons, has drafted in Ian Paisley and Sammy Wilson, the two true Brexiteers in the among the 10 DUP MPs. And they've been working on these kind of Brexiteers that they've been so close to for a number of years, trying to bring them over. And so there would be figures like, for example, if you think of a Conservative backbencher, Richard Drax. He voted against Mrs. May's deal twice, but then he voted for it on the third occasion. And after that, he used a point of order in the House of Commons to apologize to the DUP for doing so. Now, will he be able to vote for a deal that they have made clear is, as far as they're concerned, a betrayal of the union? So this is where the numbers can shift as the day goes on. And so there are a lot of waivers, and the ERG is going to meet tomorrow morning, and they say that they will then kind of announce their position, but they're not likely to vote as a group in any case, because some of them have already said they're going to support the deal, and it's pretty clear at least one or two of them won't.
That's a wonderfully detailed picture you paint of complexity, confusion and intrigue. I'm surprised by a couple of those points there, Dennis, because I, in my naivety, thought that the vast majority of the 21 Conservative MPs who lost lost the party whip when they voted against Johnson would vote for this deal, because the vast majority of them had voted for Theresa May's deal. Does this in a way go to back up some of the arguments against those people, or the criticisms of those people from inside the Conservative Party, that they were just Remainers all along?
Yeah, there's some of that. I think there's also personal animosity comes into some of these things. But also then I think that, I think there is a difference between Theresa May's deal and this deal when you look at it from the economic point of view, because what Theresa May's deal was talking about was a very closely integrated economic relationship between Britain and the European Union, including frictionless trade, or as close to frictionless trade, so that you would have, essentially they would be following EU regulations to a great extent. And then what Boris Johnson is speaking about and what's written into this new declaration is a much more independent one. And so it's really talking about, apart from Northern Ireland, that really what his vision is for a very hard break economically with the rest of the European Union. And it's been made clear to him in Brussels this week that if he's looking for a free trade agreement that has zero tariffs and zero quotas, then he's going to have to agree to all of these level playing field provisions, as they're called, about, say, state aid rules and competition rules that he doesn't really want to sign up to. And so I think you could make an argument, if you were a Conservative who voted for Theresa May's deal but didn't like this one, that actually you're doing it on economic grounds rather than just because you actually don't want Brexit to happen at all.
So set against that overall landscape, if we were just for a moment to make the assumption that despite the efforts of Sammy Wilson and Ian Paisley, most of the ERG Spartans still vote yes tomorrow. The biggest variable, is it fair to say, is those Labour MPs, because I see all kinds of numbers, everything from 4 or 5 up until 20. There was a Labour staunch Brexiteer, Labour backbencher on RTÉ Radio this morning. He was saying the number of Labour MPs who would vote for this had been grossly underestimated in the media. Is that the big unknown?
Yeah, it is the big unknown, and part of it is that although the Labour whipping operation is unlikely to be quite as drastic as the Conservative one, I mean, I think we can expect Boris Johnson's whips to tell any of these ERG people that if they vote against the deal, that they will lose the whip and they will not be allowed to stand as Conservative candidates in the next election. I don't think Labour is going to tell its people anything like that. And there is some suspicion among Remainers, for example, that would quite suit Jeremy Corbyn's purposes to have Brexit out of the way, but to have clean hands, so that actually the election, whenever it comes, would not be fought on Brexit, and it would be fought on regular, normal domestic issues. And so there's some suspicion that they might turn a blind eye. But there are other pressures. And so there are pressures, for example, from their constituency parties. And in many of the, for many of these people, the constituency party is dominated by people who favour Remain and also people who really will not forgive them for walking across the floor to help Boris Johnson to a famous victory. Now, what some Conservative MPs are saying to, potentially recruitable Labour MPs is that actually, if this deal goes down, that Boris Johnson will fight some kind of people versus parliament election, and that that then would put them in a difficult position in their seats where, you know, where most people voted to leave the European Union. And so that really they would be much safer if actually this deal happened. Everybody would kind of forget about Brexit, and whenever the election comes, they'll, you know, people will go back to their normal tribal loyalties. And so those people are wrestling with all of these competing forces and different kinds of pressures on them. And that's part of what makes it difficult. I think what some of them need is a bit of cover. So if, for example, there was something juicy on workers' rights, that would help. What has also helped or could help is what Leo Varadkar said in Brussels today, and Emmanuel Macron as well. Macron said that he didn't think there ought to be an extension. Any more extensions to Britain's membership of the European Union. And Leo Varadkar said at his press conference that MPs voting tomorrow in the House of Commons shouldn't assume, they would be mistaken to assume that there was the necessary unanimity at the in the European Council to agree an extension. Now, both of those are things which could potentially, although they're not actually decisions, of course, and who knows what the European Council will do if it's asked for an extension. But at least if you needed a bit of cover, you might be able to say, look, it's quite clear that if we don't pass this deal, then we're going to crash out with no deal because the Europeans won't let us stay in.
Although Emmanuel Macron did say something similar before one of the previous deadlines, I think earlier this year, and it didn't actually turn out in the end. And the noises coming from Angela Merkel today were rather different, but it does look, doesn't it, as if both Leo Varadkar and Emmanuel Macron are doing that sort of thing which, you know, dodgy characters, you know, do outside shops and say, you know, you wouldn't want your window broken, would you? So maybe you might want to give me a couple of quid.
Exactly. That's right. Yes, exactly. I myself abhor violence, but the gentleman that employs me, unfortunately, that kind of thing. So I think they're certainly trying to help. And, and of course, it is really true, actually, that, you know, you do need the unanimous support of all 27 leaders to agree an extension. So if one of them says no, then it's not going to happen. That's not usually the way these things work, but still it's possible.
For the Remainers in Parliament, and as we know, there are plenty of them, what's the best strategy in all this, do you think?
I think probably the best strategy is to say that, first of all, they're going to have plenty of amendments. So one of the amendments is going to say that no matter what happens tomorrow, that Boris Johnson will still have to seek an extension. So that even if his bill passes, that it has to seek an extension, because then there are other opportunities further along in the enabling legislation where he might be tripped up, say, for example, with an amendment calling for a confirmatory referendum, saying this thing can't come into effect before you have a referendum confirming it. And so I think that's probably the best way to play it. But also, of course, just to put an awful lot of pressure on the people who are in their party or the people who are susceptible to their pressures.
And just in relation, and finally, Dennis, if you wouldn't mind, to what you were just describing there, this is a fairly complicated and technical parliamentary process, which doesn't come to an end with a vote tomorrow. And there have been some noises from some quarters, I think, including the DUP, a suggestion that the other measures which will need to be passed pretty quickly if they're to meet the October 31st deadline, or pretty quickly even if they go beyond it, that each one could be an equally tight vote with the possibility of failing and just spreading chaos on you.
That's true. And actually, I think, I think that probably the, any of those rebels who really take the step to go across the floor tomorrow, that you ought to do whatever it is they do tomorrow, if it's a big step, they're probably likely to follow through in the rest of the enabling legislation. I think a bigger potential problem is amendments. So if amendments are attached, which actually have the potential to wreck things, that those might conceivably get some support. And so, I mean, I think what Boris Johnson will try to do is to get this through as quickly as possible. So what they're really banking on is momentum. And so the deal agreed yesterday, lots of pressure today, this voting tomorrow, and then try to move all of this stuff through as quickly as possible and sit at weekends if necessary. And just get it done before anybody has time to breathe or think about it or to get their balance back. But I think if you're looking at this vote tomorrow, it really is impossible for anybody, no matter who they are, to say exactly how it'll go. And I think it's very possible that it really will be down to a question of one or two votes in the end.
We'll be glued to it. Thanks for joining us, Dennis.
Thank you.
It's time to focus on what matters. Nourish your mind with Headspace and the Irish Times. Headspace connects you to yourself. The Irish Times connects you to the truth. Headspace gives you a healthy perspective. The Irish Times gives you a wider perspective. Take a premium digital subscription with the Irish Times and enjoy 12 months free access to the Headspace app. Pause. Breathe. Focus. Subscribe at irishtimes.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Fintan O'Toole, when Boris Johnson was in Dublin just a couple of weeks ago, he said that a failure for both sides to agree a deal on Brexit would be a failure of statecraft. So is this now a triumph of statecraft?
Well, it is, but it's primarily a triumph of Irish statecraft. I mean, you know, when Johnson said, of course, he said it would be a failure of statecraft on all our parts, which was pretty much kind of passing the buck, you know. What has happened, and I think, you know, the Irish Times gives excellent descriptions of it today, you know, is essentially that Irish diplomats and then Irish politicians came up with a solution and effectively offered it to Johnson, and Johnson seized on it as a way out of his dilemma. I can't think of any parallel in, you know, Anglo-Irish relations throughout the entire, you know, all the many centuries of it, you know, where Irish diplomacy really has been able to potentially shape British destiny in the same way.
Well, that's extremely interesting, because, to be honest, I didn't quite think of it that way. I suppose because I thought perhaps naively that it takes two to tango, and I've perhaps been a bit over focused on what was happening on the British side, and perhaps that it was a little less passive than you're indicating there. You know, Dominic Cummings and his famous decision tree. Do you think that it had any role in this? Do you think that there was at all a roadmap on the Johnson government side that certain actions would take place as a consequence of certain things not happening or happening in this lead up to this kind of, I suppose, the point of the summit this week?
I think it's been pretty clear, hasn't it, in the last few weeks that the Cummings strategy was really running out of road. You know, it was all based on the kind of classic confrontational model, you know, on the belief that if we just shout louder and make more and more hysterical demands, that we will effectively get what we want. And if we create chaos, we prorogue parliament, we do all these kind of extraordinary things, that we will have to be appeased. And that ran out of road, I think, in a lot of different ways, but you could kind of see it. I think there was a very interesting moment, which maybe didn't get a huge amount of attention, about 10 days ago, I think it was now, when Johnson told the so-called One Nation Tories, like what's left of them, you know, the sort of moderate Tories, he gave them a commitment that no deal would not be in the Tory manifesto for the election. Now, that was a huge climb down from the entire Cummings strategy, right? So. You know, the whole Cummings strategy was threaten no deal. If Parliament stops us, fantastic, even better. We run to the country then on a no deal platform that neutralizes Farage, and it sort of has a very simple message for the election. You know, it's going to be run on the same basis as the Brexit referendum campaign in the first place. Now, Johnson giving the commitment to the moderate Tories that he wasn't going to do that, I think, was a moment when you began to realize that they were beginning to realize that this is not working, right? This is over, you know, that he has been boxed in. And I genuinely think they were flailing. I don't think there's any indication that, I mean, it was clear to them what they couldn't do, but I don't think at that point they knew how to get a deal. And this is where I think Irish diplomacy, you know, played an extraordinary role, in that it was clearly Ireland who stepped in. And perhaps, presumably, have been thinking about this for quite a long time, you know, keeping the strategy quiet, but at the right moment coming in and saying, look, there's two things we can do for you. We can get you some kind of mechanism of consent. It's not going to be a veto for the DUP, but we can work on that. We can do something on that. And all you have to do then, and we will you know, put this forward to the European Union, is go back to the Northern Ireland only backstop with a bit of extra language on it. It does seem pretty clear that strategy came from Ireland. And I think, you know, for Irish diplomats to have managed this, right, so both kind of keep the European Union on side, you know, keep them very well informed, make it clear that they weren't going on a solo run, all of that strategy, which was really crucial, but also to open up enough space to be able to say to Johnson, look, this is your way out. Now, of course, it required Johnson to shaft the DUP. But I don't think, frankly, it was a huge leap of the imagination to imagine Johnson shafting anybody, right? So, you know, that was the big stumbling block. But we know enough about Johnson to know that he's perfectly capable of doing that.
And yet we find ourselves, and perhaps this is also part of strategic thinking on the Irish side of the equation, we now find ourselves in a situation where a lot of commentators have suggested that no matter what happens tomorrow at Westminster, no matter whether this deal is passed or if it fails to pass, and we then move to a general election in fairly short order, in which Boris Johnson will now be brandishing this deal in one hand and saying, vote for me so I can deliver this and we can move on. Either way, it's a win-win for Johnson.
If he gets it through, undoubtedly it's a win for Johnson, right? It gets him out of the hole that he had dug for himself, and it does allow him then to go into an election saying, I'm the guy who delivered Brexit. I'm not sure about the either way, though. I think if he loses the vote, surely if you think it through, you know, there will be an election very quickly, and he's going to try and go on, you know, I'm the guy who tried to deliver Brexit and they stopped me. But his problem is that it keeps Farage alive, right? So there is now a concrete deal. It's different from running on no deal, right? Running on no deal is running on fantasy. You know, it's a wonderful, blunt slogan. It doesn't have content, right? It's just it's not all these horrible things that are going to happen to you. It's the clean break. You know, that's that idea has a kind of powerful simplicity to it. The problem of running on if he has to run on an actual deal, it still allows Labour to say, well, hold on a minute, look at this political declaration, look at what he's trying to do. Look at, you know, the potential undermining of labor standards, of environmental standards, all that kind of stuff. So there's something concrete there for Labour to say. But also there's something concrete for Farage to say. You know, Farage doesn't need too much excuse. But if Brexit is delivered by October 31st, what happens to the Brexit Party, right? It's gone, right? It doesn't matter how much they complain about it. They can't run against it because it's done. But if it's still there, if it's still open and it's a concrete deal on the table, I think Farage can still run. And if Farage can still run, Farage can take 10% of the vote. And that then, you know, makes Johnson's strategy of getting his majority, I think, all the more difficult.
I think, though, that it might be the case, and it's too early. We haven't seen any opinion polls yet in the UK on what people think of this deal. I mean, the reality is, as we know, that the main variation, as far as the average UK voter is going to be on this from Theresa May's deal, pertains to Northern Ireland. And we also know from plenty of opinion polls that that's not their most important consideration. In fact, far from it. And so that, therefore, the deal on the table would be, if not perfect, attractive enough for the Get Brexit Done contingent.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think there's a kind of snap opinion poll, I think, just out from YouGov, which shows like very strong public support for getting the deal done. You know, I think about 44% of people want to get the deal done. Only something like, I think, 26% say, no, don't do this deal. So yes, from that point of view, the calculation is if the deal is done, it satisfies that sort of broad swathes of people, and it does allow him to claim this great achievement. I'm the guy who got Brexit done, right? So that does work. However, if he doesn't get it done, if it's still dragging on and he goes into an election but it's still open, I think some of that is undercut. You know, the appeal for a lot of those people, so you've got the sort of convinced Brexiteers for whom, you know, Brexit itself is the holy grail, and that's fine. But the key constituency is the sort of the other 10 to 20% of people who say, just get the bloody thing done. I want it over. But if it's not over, what Farage can do then is Farage can come in and say, he's going back, he's going to go back into negotiations with them. Even if he gets this deal through Parliament, he's going to go back in and negotiate. And Farage, you know, because it's complete nonsense, but Farage has spun this idea that no deal is the only pure Brexit. So any deal, you know, can be presented to a part of that sort of hard Brexit constituency as a compromise. And, you know, so that's, I think, where some of the difficulty for Johnson lies. The other thing is, we know from political history that electorates are funny. Like, they don't thank you for what you've done. You know, like, when you come to a general election, they're interested, like, what's next? Like, what are you going to do for us now? And so, yes, obviously, there will be some kind of backwash from getting Brexit done if he does it. But remember, this is Britain, the country that threw Winston Churchill out immediately after the Second World War. You know, like, you know, thanks, Winston. You were a fantastic wartime leader. We all love you, you know, but we're not electing you. So I just don't think you can be absolutely certain that this narrative, you know, of Johnson riding to a massive overall majority on the basis of having done Brexit is going to play itself out.
No, I think that's very true. Although it should be said that Jeremy Corbyn is no Clement Attlee, and he had been in government for 5 years before and all that kind of. I want to move on, if I may, just briefly to the situation in Northern Ireland, because obviously all this entire negotiation and debate essentially centred around Northern Ireland. What do you think of the analysis that the DUP made at fatal strategic error when they agreed to let regulatory checks be put into the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and Britain 3 weeks ago, that opened the door for everything that followed?
I remember reading it when that proposal came out. We saw it first, and I was really flummoxed. I just could not understand it. You know, I couldn't see why the DUP had signed up to a regulatory border, you know, and was then saying, but it's okay because we're still in the customs union. And I still don't understand, frankly. I don't know what they were thinking, because they conceded precisely on the big principle and then didn't solve the problem. You know, so they made their enormous concession, and yet the precise problem was still there. I mean, it actually did nothing to solve the border question. So it was just inexplicable, I think. And it showed, I think, their really poor grasp of strategic thinking. Tactically, they've been brilliant. You know, tactically, they will, you know, obfuscate, and they will harangue, and they'll wait to the last moment and get something out of it. They're very good at sort of doing that stuff. But strategically, I think Brexit has, in general, has shown them to be just strategically inept.
It strikes me about all this that one of the things, when we look back at this historically in a few years' time, it may be seen that what the DUP are claiming this week, one element of it may be true, which is that this marks a very important turning point in the history of post-Belfast Agreement Northern Ireland, that the dispensation which was put in place at the Good Friday Agreement, where checks and balances and safeguards were put in place, that both communities had a veto, essentially, or had to reach consensus on certain issues, that's been there now for more than two decades. It had been running into the sand for the last few years for various reasons. And now, with this move to majoritarianism, which, of course, the DUP was in favour of for many, yes, many years, we perhaps start seeing the outlines of a new Northern Ireland. It's been said to me that one of the factors which people haven't been looking at closely enough in the changes that are going on in Northern Ireland is the growth in the number of people who are neither voting for nationalist or unionist parties. And so now there's a new kind of majoritarianism which will require capturing the centre in order to hold political power.
I think that puts it extremely well, and I think you're absolutely right about it. You know, I think what we've seen this week is huge. You know, it's seismic in terms of the future of the island of Ireland and the future, the relationships between Ireland and Britain. You know, there's no way back, even if this deal does not go through. The fact that a British Prime Minister and a right-wing British Prime Minister, Tory British Prime Minister, has signed up to a process that will inevitably lead to, you know, greater and greater distancing of Northern Ireland from Great Britain is just astonishing, you know. And yes, I think that's absolutely true. And then the implications for that, which we're already seeing working out in exactly the way you've said, which is that in this new circumstance, the sectarian mechanisms, which, and let's call them what they are, but they are sectarian mechanisms, which were built into the Belfast Agreement, this sort of nice kind of cross-community idea. But it's basically saying there are two blocks. There's a Catholic block and a Protestant block. And, you know, they have to have some sort of mechanism of joint consent. That it is no longer fit for purpose. It was always hugely problematic because it always denied the fact that even in 1998 there were not two traditions, right? There were always three traditions in Northern Ireland. There was the two tribes and the none of the above. And exactly as you say, the none of the above has grown and grown. And you cannot go back to saying, you know, that there are these sectarian vetoes on either side. You know, this radically disenfranchises, you know, what's increasingly a third part of the population of the entire polity. You know, it's not just population, but it's part of the way in which Northern Ireland exists right now. And Brexit, I think, has animated that third force, you know, to a much greater extent. So there's no question but that in the fallout from all of this, the Belfast Agreement is going to have to be renegotiated. Its internal architecture hasn't been working well, very obviously. We don't have an assembly. But also the assumptions underlying that internal architecture, which is that there's just two traditions and you have to have parity of esteem between them, that has to be revisited. It just doesn't match the reality anymore.
Mm. Finally, Fintan, there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast, both in the UK and in Ireland, who will have held out a hope up until now that this might not happen, that the United Kingdom would change its mind, there'd be a second referendum or some other electoral event, Article 50 would be withdrawn and the United Kingdom would not leave the European Union. Is it time for us to put those dreams aside?
I think it may well be. You know, it's a very bittersweet few days, isn't it? Because on the one side, it's, you know, from an Irish point of view, it's sweet. I think no matter how you look at this, this is an extraordinary achievement for the Irish state. And it, if it goes through, it really does lift that terrible cloud of this threat of the return of this border. So it's a really wonderful moment. But the price of it, of course, is going to be paid by our friends in Britain. You know, what really hasn't come across, because there's been so much focus on the backstop or now the front stop as it is, that, you know, people haven't maybe realized that the cost of this is that it allows Johnson to do a much more extreme hard Brexit, bordering on a no deal Brexit. I mean, so what this kind of lays the seeds for, I mean, it's kind of hard to get your head around, but Johnson has sold out to DUP, is going to pay all the money, and he's going to hang around for another 2 years or whatever, and then potentially just do a no deal Brexit, you know, because that's what's there. I mean, if he doesn't get his trade deal in the terms that he wants, you know, he's made it pretty clear that they'll just walk away at that point. So this could be potentially awful for Britain. And we in Ireland can't insulate ourselves from that, right? So even though I think the state's done a fantastic job of damage limitation insofar as it can, those longer term costs that are going to be paid by Britain are also, you know, economic costs that are going to be paid by Ireland as well. And I think, you know, maybe still a slim hope that if Johnson's deal is defeated on Saturday, or, you know, it could even, who knows, it could go on, be pushed into next week at some point, we don't really know. But if it doesn't go through and you go to an election, it's still not impossible that you could have a Remainer majority in Parliament. You know, we don't know this. It's still very much up in the air. And if there is one, it's still, you know, its only option really is to go for the second referendum. So I don't think it's impossible that you could end up with a second referendum and no Brexit. I think the chances of it have hugely diminished over the course of the week. On Monday, if we'd been talking about this, you know, we probably would have said, actually, the chances of second referendum are now looking reasonably good. And now they look pretty bleak.
Oh, that's a reasonable cautionary note for whatever might happen in the future. Fintan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for today's show. Thanks to Fintan and to Dennis for joining us. Thanks also to Declan Conlon, our producer. Remember that you can subscribe to us on all the usual places. You can mail me at hlinahan@irishtimes.com, or you can usually find me on Twitter. Until the next time, thanks for listening.